as one is talking to people about their experience of place, what did they lose? And the really important question to start with is, what did you have?
At Home with Growing Older is a nonprofit organization which believes in peer learning and creating discussions which bring the lens of aging to a variety of topics. At Home with Growing Older is proud to be your host of At Home on Air, a radio hour offering connection, community, and knowledge to our participants remotely. Now, we invite you to listen and learn from this live recorded episode of At Home on Air.
Welcome. Thank you for joining us. I'm Susie Stadler, an architect by profession and the executive director of At Home with Growing Older. I'm also the producer of this program, At Home on Air. For us, the meaning of being at home is twofold. First, it refers to how we can live and thrive in our home environments. And second, how we can come to feel at home with growing older in our wider communities and within ourselves. Dr. Mindy Fullerlove is our guest in this episode. She's a social psychiatrist and activist who has dedicated her career to studying the impact of urban environments on the mental health of its citizens, such as the mental health impact of displacements that followed the urban renewal projects of the 1950s. Her work and activism bridges disciplines. She is probably the only, to my knowledge, social psychiatrist who is an honorary member of the American Institute of Architects. I first came across Dr. Fullerlove's work when I did research for an article about the importance of joy and celebration to build community as an antidote to social isolation. One of Dr. Fullerlove's great books, Urban Alchemy, what a wonderful title, was a revelation and inspiration for me. Dr. Fullerlove, thank you so much for joining us. I'm so honored to talk to you. I would love to start this conversation with a quote from you that stuck with me. When we move in ways we are forbidden to do, we create new possibilities. That is how we rupture what we're stuck in. You named closing streets for parties and potlucks as one of the examples, but I feel the simple guerrilla tactics could refer to so many other actions that can bring us together and bridge divides. How does this insight relate to the psychology of place, the discipline you contributed in such a significant way? And are these guerrilla tactics also part of your own activism?
Susie, thank you so much for the question. You mentioned that I'm a social psychiatrist. So, you know, my perspective on this is different from people who are coming at it from psychology or anthropology or philosophy or sociology, because psychiatry is very, very grounded in mental illness. Social psychiatrists, we flip it a little bit because we're interested in how does the organization of society lead to mental illness or mental health. And so that's kind of the perspective that I'm bringing to it. I became so engaged with the psychology of place because I was working in Central Harlem, which had suffered from decades of very vicious urban policy, which had decimated the neighborhood so that it had lost 30% of its housing between 1960 and 1990, and was in the midst, when I first started working there, of a series of epidemics, what we called mad plagues. So there was the AIDS epidemic and a crack epidemic and a violence epidemic and a mental illness related to violence epidemic and an asthma epidemic and an obesity epidemic. We were studying all these things in such a short period of time. To be studying epidemics and walking down the street where the buildings were gone was really stunning to me. Nothing in my training as a psychiatrist had helped me understand what might be the relationship between a decimated physical environment and such an intense series of epidemics. There's a paper that was published in 1990 by Drs. McCord and Freeman, which pointed out that the life expectancy of Black men in Central Harlem at that time was less than the life expectancy of men in Bangladesh, which was at that point one of the poorest countries on earth. So how does devastation of a neighborhood relate to this massive loss of life? and terribly unstable living conditions. I didn't know the answer, and that's why I turned to people like Claire Marcus, who were writing about the psychology of place. I was fascinated to think about their insights about the ways in which place is not take it or leave it, but a fundamental, in the terms of the psychoanalyst, a fundamental object of our attachment, of our affection, within which we are orienting ourselves to the world. So take the place that you're attached to, that you love, where your world is grounded, and destroy it. What happens to the person? And that led me to some decades of interviewing people who had had various experiences. One of the first things I did was just sort of start reading everything that had what I called a place story in the title. My alumni magazine had a story about a woman who got lost in the woods for 3 days. So I called her up, tell me about getting lost in the woods. And some friends who blended their family and moved in with each other's children. I said, tell me about blending a family. Now it's literally thousands of interviews later, trying to understand from all different perspectives what happens when we lose a place. And then that led me into the opposite question, how do we rebuild? Which is what urban alchemy is about. All the visits I had with urbanists and architects, mainly in the US and France, but also Japan and other countries, just saying, what is it you do? From that, I tried to abstract what I call the elements of urban restoration. The thing that you're quoting, when we move in a way we're not allowed, we learn something new, really came out of my experience studying in France with the renowned architect urbanist Michel Cantal Dupart. Big French guy, big white French guy, very tall, has great posture. And he would go marching into the mayor's office or anybody's office, and I would go trotting after him. This was an extraordinary experience because there were places that, you know, as an American, I couldn't go, as a Black woman, I couldn't go. And so to just go into these places in his wake, like, how do you enter if you're a white man? It's a really cool experience. I mean, I project it, but for me, it was really cool. I was never allowed to go to those places, to talk to those people, to walk in that way. But walking with him, I did. So it was really cool, wonderful experience. So generalizing from that, when we change how we use the space, then everything changes. I'm sure you've heard the expression that's often given as advice to people who are depressed, move a muscle, change a thought. Walk in space a different way. Follow somebody that you never followed before. You know, if you're a white man, follow some small woman. See what happens. Try to walk after her. See where you can go and where you can't and what it's like. I fundamentally believe that part of what we have to do is move in new ways, connect in new ways. Here we are in the aftermath of COVID, and we get to move in this new way. We're all at home, right? We get to visit each other's homes and offices. I love this. No two people have the same looking home. You're not in the same spot in any two people's houses. People complain about the little boxes, but I think it's fun. The other thing is that after COVID, people don't in New York, in this area, don't want to come back out. So when we give an event for students, they don't come. People don't want to go to concerts. They don't want to go to movies. How do you get people moving together? And yet people are also resentful of Zoom. I don't want to be on Zoom. Or they go on Zoom, but they don't turn on their cameras. So how do we invite people to turn on their cameras? All of these are issues of movement. How are we going to move together? I've been going on, and you didn't stop me, so thank you.
I didn't stop you on purpose. Thank you. That was a great start to this conversation. I was just thinking when you talked about how interesting it is to get a glimpse into people's homes on Zoom, wouldn't it be great if we could also get a glimpse into their neighborhoods? You know, obviously that's not possible, but neighborhoods are so much part of our home. You talked about how neighborhoods were disrupted through urban renewal and other tactics. I'm wondering how we can work ourselves out of this situation where we don't connect anymore in our neighborhoods.
You know, it's probable that in the United States, we do connect in our neighborhoods, but we don't connect across neighborhoods. Tom Hanchett has called the sorting of the American city by race and class. The way that's worked is we all live in little enclaves where it's uniform about race and class. So when you say we can't see each other's neighborhoods, I bet we could look at each person's little window and make some wild guesses about their neighborhoods, right? We wouldn't be far off because we know what the sorting of the city did. Tom Hanchett studied the city of Charlotte, North Carolina, and his book, if you haven't read it, is just astounding. It's called Sorting Out the New South City. And what he documents is the ways in which the policies work to take a city that was quite mixed by race and class and then divide the people out by race and class. Part of the process of that has been putting dividers in between these little sections so that it's not as easy to move. So it's easy to move within, but not across. Kind of like we're all in subdivisions and we're trapped in them. So how do you help people move across? That's something that my colleagues and I at the University of Orange have thought about a lot. And one of the things that we do is just take people for walks. We like to invite people to come to Orange, New Jersey and take a walk with us. Orange, New Jersey has the great blessing of being a little city, 2.2 square miles. And we like to say that everything you want to know about the history of the American city, you can learn in Orange, New Jersey. So it's remarkable just to walk around there. We have a park designed by the Olmsted brothers. We have a library designed by Stanford White. We have one of the early pastoral cemeteries like Mount Auburn in Boston, Rosedale Cemetery. We also have the remnants of the Italian ghetto, the Black ghetto. We have a highway through the middle of town. We have the old factories, which were abandoned in deindustrialization. We have a wealthy subdivision, which was designed by the Olmsted brothers. All of these things that are going on in the American city, we have. You can see them right there. When they put in housing projects that were segregated by race, we have those. We have markers of the old forms of segregation that you could only see if you knew that there was segregation. We don't have that segregation now, so you can't see them. And massive gentrification. Orange is a poor city that's in need of thousands of affordable housing units. But what are we getting? Thousands of market rate apartments because we're so-called transit oriented and that's what we need. Walk around, see things, talk to people, you know, eat some good food. It's that kind of vital experience of getting out of your usual and walking around with other people. I think that's how it starts and you have to just get excited about it.
What a great plan for action. Take people for a walk. When you talked about Orange, New Jersey and the history of the American city being on such a small footprint, this generational knowledge of a place, the information that belongs to a community that has lived there for a long time. And when this information is disrupted or cut off because people are uprooted, you talk about this in your book, Root Shock. Is there a way that this can be restored? And what role do elders in a community play? Do they have a responsibility to tell the story of the place?
In our day and age, upheaval is everywhere. Even the most stable places are not stable in the way they were. When I was studying urban renewal and came up with this idea of root shock, the ways in which losing one's home and neighborhood reverberate through a community, through one's life, through generations. I defined root shock as the loss of all or part of one's emotional ecosystem. By that definition, all of us have lost the climate that we knew, and therefore all of us have root shock. 8 billion people, think about that. 8 billion people have root shock. These kinds of things create feedback loops. So something happens, the weather changes, flowers are blooming at the wrong time, there's drought where there should be water, there's water where there should not be water. All of these things are going on, we're feeling them in our bodies and we're living with them. How do people react to instability, unpredictability, uncontrollability? They don't manage those things well. We don't like uncertainty, we like certainty. So they retreat in tribal ways. We're already sorted by race and class. So we retreat along lines of race and class. One can feel the weather is bad, but one can say there's nothing happening to the weather, it's the immigrants. A very logical statement under such conditions. The issue is that we're kind of in this Sisyphean dilemma where we keep breaking and we fix and we break and we fix, but we're breaking faster than we can fix. And some of the how to fix, we actually have no answers. So it's really a question of how does a group of people, how does anybody manage a Sisyphean space?
Sometimes these monumental upheavals, we can't fix it, but we can start rebuilding in small ways in neighborhoods. The local communities actually become even more important than they were ever before. That's why it's also important to invest in the health of these local communities.
You know, they say that you ought to plan that if there's a disaster, nobody will be there for 72 hours, which is kind of dire. But you should have 72 hours of stuff in your house, like water and food. And you should know your neighbors because they're the only people who can get to you in a disaster. So I live in New Jersey, which we think of as a very stable place, but we had an earthquake last week and a few houses fell off their foundations. It was 4.8, which is not the biggest, not what they had in Taiwan, but we're not prepared. If we had a 7.8, we would have been in big trouble. My point is not that we should have disaster preparedness. My point is that you should know your neighbors. We all should know our neighbors. I know my neighbors to nod to, but I don't know their names. I don't have their phone numbers. What if something happened? Who would come and save me in the first 72 hours? I'm not very well prepared. So building the neighborhood is important on many levels. But just as a process, if people are breaking up neighborhoods faster than we can fix them, really it gets ahead of us. And that's the problem that we face in the United States. Gentrification is causing a lot of turmoil in neighborhoods. In my neighborhood, housing prices went up 10% in the past year. My house, which is a small house, not a big house, what they call a starter home, the price has tripled since I bought it 15 years ago. That's outrageous. My children couldn't afford to buy a house in my neighborhood. Why does that make any sense? And that destabilizes things. So we talk about intergenerational knowledge, but what if your children can't live anywhere near you? So the real question becomes not, can we repair it? We can repair it. But what if the processes that are destabilizing us are moving faster than the processes of repair? That's the problem that we have to face as an emotional problem. Interestingly, I think that the sun becomes very important. You know, we had this eclipse and so many people went to see it. And there was a diagram today of the traffic jams on the path of totality. Huge traffic jams all along the path of totality. All the people trying to get there. If you think about the sun, I don't think the sun is changing. The sun is like out there, it's doing its thing. You know, a solstice, an eclipse, an equinox, these things become compass points that become more and more and more meaningful as we're trying to say, what do we hang on to? What do we orient by? You know, you look for the North Star. What's the North Star in this? How are we going to find our way? For me as a psychiatrist, how do we calm people? How do we say, yeah, the situation's a little out of control. We can celebrate the solstice. That's sort of the challenge that I work with. It's not enough to say we can repair. Yeah, we can repair. But the people who break things can break things faster than we can repair them. So that changes the equation.
Yes, and it was a really unexpected answer you gave, was the sun. But it makes sense. The concentric circles of the home, the neighborhood, the city, the world, I mean, the universe, it seems interesting that from our perspective, which of course, from an astronomer's perspective, I'm sure is not correct, but from our perspective, the universe provides stability and keeps us rooted in our earthly existence. So that's really an interesting perspective. And I think many people felt it, you know, people were moved to tears when the eclipse occurred.
Yes, yes.
Going from the universe to the very personal experience, the experience many people have as they grow older, that when they get uprooted because they have to move out of their community for financial reasons, for caregiving reasons, etc., the same principles and the same issues come up in terms of mental health for people who are uprooted because of older age and the needs of older age. And I wonder if you have thought about this.
There's no question. A variety of this experience of root shock happens to people as they age, but varieties of it. If you're living in a neighborhood and your whole neighborhood is bulldozed and you lose all your neighbors and you don't know where they went, that's extreme. But if your neighborhood is fine, but you had to move, but you could go back to your neighborhood and see it, that's slightly different. So I think it's important as one is talking to people about their experience of place, what did they lose? And The really important question to start with is, what did you have?
Yes, we always ask people in our workshops, what do you love about your home? It's sort of a related question. What do you have? I wonder if we can talk a little bit more about the power of the individual to improve places we hold in common. You brought up the example of taking others for a walk, but what other powers do we have to improve places we are concerned with, we care for, we feel responsible for?
All relationships are reciprocal. What do I put in? What does the place put in? So there's that back and forth. You know, one of the responsibilities we have towards place where we have completely violated our responsibility is that it shouldn't be abusive. And we collectively have been very abusive, and hence we're causing this profound damage to the ecosystem that's driving us from the Holocene to the Anthropocene. All the ways in which we throw chemicals around that, you know, are forever, they're always going to be there, or trash, mountains of mountains and mountains and mountains of trash that we don't know where it's going to go. Soil erosion. Soil is one of the most precious things on earth, but we let the soil erode, tearing down trees. And each of us participates in this abuse of place at every level of scale. I just get upset every week when I put my garbage out. Like, why do I have all this garbage? I'm just one person, and I look up and down the street, it's a lot of garbage. Where is it going to go? There's no place for it to go because there's no there, right? The environmentalists are very clear. There's no here and there. It's all here, and there's no us and them. Like, we'll put it over there by them. There's no there by them. It's all us. If we really understand what the ecologists have taught us. So at the heart of our responsibilities towards place is that we shouldn't be abusive. And we don't know how we're going to back ourselves out of that. A lot of people are saying, well, there's some things that I'm doing and they're not very meaningful, but I'm trying. And I think that's good. It sets us on the right path, but we have to also be thinking, how is the collective of the 8 billion people going to start moving in a direction of a kind relationship where we are not being abusive towards place?
Yeah, what this requires is the stewardship of the land, urban land and all other land, thinking about land in terms of stewardship and not ownership. And I think that's what you just said. We need to make it about survival.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
You are listening to At Home on Air. We are now switching to questions by participating audience members in this recorded live episode. If you want a chance to ask your question, visit us at homewithgrowingolder.org and register for the next live episode.
One question is from Lisa Ari. I'm thinking of Gaza and the dramatic destabilization of place for the Palestinians, and what, as a collective, the world community will face.
I think that in posing this question, we have to think about some larger level of scale. We can't think about Palestine or Israel in a way we have to think about the larger unit, because, you know, it's a war going on. And as soon as we say one side and not the other side, then it's in a way becomes taking part in the war. If we want to talk about the consequences, we have to look at the whole. When people go to war, they drop a lot of bombs, they kill a lot of people. What's happening to the whole thing? In my opinion, at this moment, Israel, Gaza, West Bank, and the DMZ are the flashpoints where the world systems of imperialism come head to head. Interestingly, Kim Jong-un, who's the head of North Korea, started doing nuclear tests right after October 7th. So he read the situation in a particular way. One might also say Ukraine. Those three spots are the flashpoints of international powers coming into conflict and operating through other people. So they're almost proxy wars. What are they proxies for? They're proxies for control of land, control of resources, ordering people around. And so how do we understand that all of us are caught in this? Every single one of us. We have to begin to ask deeper questions. As somebody who spent my youth just weeping over what was happening in Vietnam, the most useful thing that I learned at that time was to think about imperialism. What was America doing there? We had no business there. I think if people can begin to think that way, then we can really understand world politics, world power struggles. That then puts us, I think, on a sounder basis for saying, what do we do? In no small part, we have to ask, what happened to all of us as a result? Why do we have these three hotspots where the global powers are coming head to head? What's going on? I'm not trying to say I know what's going on, but I'm trying to say, if you go to the DMZ, if you go to Gaza, if you go to Ukraine, or you read about those places, something is happening in the world order. And it's happening in the world order at the same time this ecological collapse is threatening all of us. Those are huge questions. And therefore, I think we need to study a lot.
Rachel Friedman asks, can you talk about mental health and what you think communities can do to create environments where people are healthier from a mental health standpoint? I'm thinking how our institutions aren't necessarily healthy environments. Also thinking about the gravity of unhoused people. So there are several things in this question.
Yeah. It's sort of like one of those questions where we're all swimming in this sea of instability. It's quite a lot of instability right now in our world. I personally think 8 billion people are a little bit unhinged right now, including myself. Just a little bit unhinged. We're more irritable, we're anxious, we're uncertain. And certainly rates of anxiety and depression are going up and up and up. So you can't get your child in to see a child psychiatrist right now, because they're overwhelmed. It's falling especially hard on the kids because they don't necessarily see a future. This goes back to the question I was saying earlier, if the world is unstable, where do you find serenity? That's an important question. Asian philosophers would have a variety of answers, but one of them is that you have to cultivate your own ability to welcome unpleasant emotions and to see that change is the only constant. If we think that things should be stable and everything should be nice and everything should be whatever we think it should be, we're going to be very unhappy because it's not going to be. But if we can say, okay, we're in some kind of worldwide system of change, and if we can get to know what our values are, and if we can say, I'm going to live my values in this process of change, then I think that we can have a certain amount of internal calm in this waves and waves of crisis, like literally crisis all around us. Does that make sense to you? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Rachel, do you have a follow-up question?
I know my question was really, really broad, but I really like the answer. I like thinking about within the sea of instability, how we can ground ourselves. I just wish there was more examples and leadership of that.
Yeah, the lack of leadership is kind of making us all a little bit crazy. I think this is a time when civil society has to really step up, because at the top, whatever the world powers are doing, civil society has to hold us. I mean, that includes our schools and our churches, and just every organization has to take some piece of, I'm going to try to help.
I was just thinking about that as you answered too, like, are more people turning to religion, turning towards different organized groups, like institutions that are aiming to try to hold people together?
I don't actually think so. Church attendance is down. Church membership is down, as an example. So I don't think they are. But that doesn't mean the organizations can't try to figure out how to take themselves out. This takes us back to the first question Susie asked, which is guerrilla actions. I'm part of a congregation that is very small, but we felt that we had resources, we have a set of buildings, we thought we could bring in funding for the city, and that by opening our doors and inviting people to come in and use the space, there aren't very many spaces for community gatherings, to use our space for community gatherings, that that was helpful. Though small, we're trying to take up our responsibilities. That's what I think people have to do. It's not that people are going to come in, it's that we have to go out.
Yes, go to the people. Trojana asks, our condo association encouraged residents to come to an eclipse viewing party, which fostered a lot of community spirit. What are other ways that can make all of us who are still trying to get out of the house after COVID really build our community?
I love that question. And I think this is where there's endless human creativity. Part of what my research team and I thought a lot about after 9/11 was the ritual calendar. The ritual calendar at that time we thought of as a weaving of collective life, where there's a warp and a woof. One's going this way and the one's going that way. So going across, you have all the holidays in order, Valentine's Day and St. Patrick's Day, April Fool's Day, all the holidays in order. But going through the years, every April 1st is April 1st. Every July 4th is July 4th. And so that's how they create this weaving of our collective life. And part of how you start to stabilize and connect is to start with the ritual calendar. And of course, into the ritual calendar come extraordinary events like a solstice or an eclipse. I do think going to the lunar calendar and the solar calendar is very important right now because it's bigger. It's so much bigger. So I would start with the ritual calendar. What's the next holiday that's coming up?
Diane Sanchez asks, what questions should mental health professionals be asking young people who are experiencing mental health issues?
Well, the news feeds that I get from various psychiatric associations is a new risk factor that we're supposed to be asking about pretty much every day. So I think the list is getting longer and longer. The one today was about the harshness of parents in preteen kids, that if preteen kids felt like they had to protect the family from their feelings, that they were then at more risk for suicidal behavior. So what do you do if there's too many things to remember? I don't like those long lists. I think what you have to do is just sit with the kid and say, how's it going? And be patient until they really tell you. So all kinds of pressures on kids, and more than we've ever seen before. We should just be assuming that they're really freaked out. Even if we don't think they have mental health issues, it's extraordinarily hard to be a kid in this moment in time.
Yes, it's so true. Howard Thornton asks, are there examples of communities creating healing places where people can come together for connecting?
The CLIMB project comes to mind as one example. So CLIMB is a project we started in 2004. It's called City Life is Moving Bodies, but really about moving bodies. The project was to create a hiking trail, which goes from Central Park all the way up through northern Manhattan to the Cloisters, through a series of cliffside parks that almost touch, not quite, but they almost touch. If you look at it on a map, it looks like a giraffe. So the icon of our project is a hiking giraffe. It's been extraordinary because it goes through different communities. Starting at the top of Central Park, you go through Morningside Heights, Harlem Heights, into Washington Heights, into Inwood. So it's going through several different communities. People hike and then they come together for a party and it builds community. And this June, the 20th anniversary, isn't that amazing? June 1st. So it's something we've been doing for 20 years. And part of doing that very small project, I mean, small in the sense of we never had a lot of money or a lot of people, but because we lifted up the parks and took people to the parks, got a lot of investment. So the parks are now very, very different from when we started. So it really has built not only community, but reintegrated the parks into the system of the city. It didn't take a lot of money. It just was this strange idea, this hiking giraffe.
Well, in a way, that's how we started the conversation today. In terms of, it was like one of the guerrilla tactics you used, which then grew into something more stable and sustainable. You know, using something in a different way helps you discover a new aspect of a place. That's very cool. Congratulations. Kathy asks, I live in a small town surrounded by rural areas. There are many, many older people who are living very isolated. They want to stay in their homes, which may need lots of work. How can we help them to not feel isolated?
Yeah, it's a profound question. Because I'm a researcher, what I do with a question like that is what we call situation analysis. Because you're describing a situation, and a situation is a complex interpersonal episode that we try to understand in its embedding context. So I would just go talk to a lot of people, certainly the older people who are living alone, but also, you know, where are their children? What do the neighbors who aren't quite as old have to say? Where are the neighbors? And then the people in the town, the healthcare providers, all the providers, I would talk to a lot of people and I would try to come up with an analysis. The really fun thing about situation analysis is that at the end of the day, after you talk to all these people and you analyze everything, you have to name the situation. And the name is very powerful because it says, this is where you have to work. Work on this. We've done tons of these. And, you know, you get to that point where you're sort of scratching your head and say, here's all this information, here's all these things. It's difficult. They're isolated. They can't drive anymore, or they can drive, but it's far and they don't have money for gas. All these things. What's the solution? When you name it, then it opens the way to something that can work. And that's what's so exciting. So that's what I would do. I don't have an answer to that question, but I know there is an answer to that question that people would like to get behind.
So it's about asking questions and listening.
That's what I would do. And then I think when we name a situation, it's always a name that was very emotional to us. It's often a quote, but it tries to capture the emotion of the way in which the situation is organized.
I'm just curious, does any example from your work come to mind? A name?
We did a study of fatal school shootings at a high school in a New York City community called East New York. At one of the funerals for one of the victims, Reverend Johnny Youngblood was listening to Mayor David Dinkins give a eulogy. And Mayor Dinkins said, we can feel great because we know that Ian is in heaven now. Or we don't have to feel bad because Ian is in heaven. Ian Moore was the young man who was killed. And Reverend Johnny Youngblood was shocked by that. And he got up and he said, I was shocked when the mayor said that because it made me think, what did Ian tell God about how we're taking care of his children? And that was kind of stunning. Like, we always say that platitude, well, he's in heaven now, so we don't have to feel. So it was like, he was shocked, he was horrified, he was upset by that. That really shocked me when Reverend Youngblood told me this story. Yet, all of what people told us about what had happened in the community was that the children were trying to make it on their own without real solid help from any of the adults. And so what Reverend Youngblood was expressing was the real complaint that the children could take to God. So we called our paper, What Did Ian Tell God?
Thank you for sharing this. You are also transitioning into a different phase in your professional life. You're retiring soon, and you're starting a very personal project. I called the project Being at Home with Growing Older. You decided to embark on a one-year project to uncover the mysteries of six generations in your own home, in the home you're living in. And I wonder if you can talk some about this process and why you're doing this.
Because there's so much stuff in my house that, you know, you get to that point where you might like to downsize, but I can't. My granddaughter actually forbid me. She said, Grandma, you can't move until you get rid of all the stuff. So I'm under this obligation to get rid of the stuff so I could move. I couldn't fit it. And plus, apartments are so expensive, right? Like, I have too much stuff to fit in an apartment. But it's not all my stuff. It's my grandparents, my parents, myself, my children, my grandchildren, and my great-grandchild. So that's six generations of stuff, not all mine. But what am I to do with it? So I'm doing a project which has the title, A Year in the Closet, the Attic, and the Basement. And we'll see what comes of it.
It's a pretty exciting project. Are you going to document this in any way with a journal, with photographs, with lists, with asking questions from your family members, what they want to keep or what the use of a certain items is or how it serves you? What is the process you think you will follow? Or what are your ideas about this?
I'm a researcher. It's like obsessional. I document everything. I have a lot of notebooks and I always write things in notebooks. I also believe in taking a lot of photos. So for sure, I'll be doing those two things. And I always talk to people because they know things. But in a way, the nice thing about this kind of process project is that it's very emergent. I don't actually know what all the stuff is in my house. And therefore, there will surely be things I encounter that are surprising that I didn't know I had. It was going to be funny. So there you have it. I'll have to stop and think about it, talk to people, figure out what to do. So it will be quite emergent.
Yes, thank you for sharing this. This is a great way to think about maybe what sometimes people very banal call reorganizing a home or even decluttering or curating. I mean, this is all of the above, but takes a very different approach to it. One is affirming and sort of serving you and the house you live in.
It's not simply decluttering.
No, it's not.
It's sort of the precious objects of six generations.
Yes, exactly. Dr. Fulof, maybe we can connect with you after your one-year project in the attic. And where else?
The basement.
The basement. Yeah. How could I forget the basement? You're very lucky.
How could you forget the basement?
You have all three of those. Thank you so much, Dr. Fulof, for this conversation today. So many different ideas, so many different insights, so many different actions we walk away with, action plans, inspirations. It was a great conversation, such a pleasure to talk to you. And I just want to remind everybody that we have another episode of At Home on Air coming up on May 9. And this time we are talking about at home in the kitchen, how our kitchen can become a spice box for healthy aging. Our guest is Dr. Linda Xu, who is a doctor at Kaiser Permanente, but also a trained chef. And she believes in culinary medicine. The interdisciplinary arc of what practices shape lives and aging experiences continues. This exploration continues on May 9. Thank you again, everybody. Bye-bye.
This episode of At Home On Air was produced by the At Home with Growing Older team. We could not host these conversations without the generosity of our marvelous and passionate guests and hosts. Thank you for sharing your personal and professional insights. Thank you to our live audience for your thoughtful contributions. To subscribe to this podcast and for more information, visit us at homewithgrowingolder.org. Thank you to our sponsors, Rhoda Goldman Plaza, the jewel of San Francisco's assisted living and memory care communities, and the Walnut Foundation, a San Francisco family foundation. At Home with Growing Older strives to educate, inspire, and connect people across generations and disciplines to re-envision and improve the experiences of later life. Don't forget to subscribe and tune in for the next episode.